morning, Council. We have four appeals to hear this morning. We're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs, at least portions of the record, and you have limited time this morning, so feel free to get straight to the heart of your argument. Be mindful of the traffic lights. When the red light shines, it's time to finish up. But if we're asking a question, you can, of course, finish your answer, and you'll be on our time. This morning, we're going to start with United States versus Hill. Ms. Webster.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to address first the severance issue and, time permitting, the multiple conspiracies issues in the second ground in our brief. The district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Hill's request to sever count three from counts one and two. Under Rule 14, if joinder appears to prejudice a defendant, severance or other relief is appropriate. And a defendant is prejudiced by the joinder if the counts are clearly distinct in time, place, and evidence, the defendant has important testimony to offer on one count but not the others, and a strong need to avoid testifying about the other counts. And part of the concern that's recognized in the case law is that if a defendant wants to testify only on certain counts but not on others, that he may be prejudiced in violation of the Fifth Amendment by remaining silent.
I understand counts. Your argument on that, but tell me about the first prong of the test.
Sure. That the counts are clearly distinct in time, place, and evidence. So I think it's clear. I don't think there's really an argument about it being distinct in time and in place, because the drug transactions that were at issue were October and November of 2016, and the incident that gave rise to count three was in January of 2018. The places are clearly separate. The drug transactions primarily occurred at 759 Charlotte Place, whereas the assault happened at a hotel in Sandy Springs. As to the evidence, the government argues that all of the evidence on both counts would have been admissible on trials on each one. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's accurate. Specifically, while the evidence that he had that there was a warrant for his arrest and that he knew about the warrant would certainly have been admissible on a trial on count three, all of the evidence on counts one and two, all of the significant amount of gang evidence that came in, evidence of all the phone calls that came in, there's no reason why that would also be admissible at a count on a trial on count three.
Why wouldn't his attempt to flee be admissible in trial on the other counts?
Yeah.
Right. So I understand that flight may be admissible on the counts on the drug counts. I think our primary concern is about the implications as to count three, which is all of the prejudicial information about the gang activity that he wasn't even a member of, but his association with people who are in that gang, and all of the testimony and things like that. When the jury should have been determining whether or not he intended to harm the officer, that evidence is hugely prejudicial at a trial on count three. And the harm here was that he wasn't allowed to give that testimony, right? He wasn't allowed to give his testimony, which was a valid defense under this court's case law in Alvarez, and even under the pattern instruction that the jury was actually
How would the cross-examinations have been different if he had tested? I mean, that seems to be the question here. As he says, I was put to this choice of either testifying or not, and I couldn't really testify because how I would have been crossed.
Well, I think it's not just about how he would have been cross-examined. It's about the fact that he would have wanted to remain silent on counts one and two, and so that goes back to the concern about remaining silent and violation of his Fifth Amendment rights. He wouldn't have been. That's sort of the bigger issue. But I do think on cross, the government cites the Berkman decision, and his cross-examination, those questions would have been limited to questions, and this is a quote, properly within the scope of cross-examination. And so if he gets up and he testifies exclusively, consistent with his statement that he made, that he had reasonable belief to question whether or not this was actually an agent who was attempting to arrest him, and that's the extent of his testimony, I don't think that the government could then go into every detail about the drug counts on counts one and two, about all of those transactions.
Really? Well, I mean, I guess maybe you're right. Maybe the detail would not have been relevant. But I mean, surely it would have been relevant to the government to say, so you didn't know that, you know, these officers were officers. Let's talk about all the crimes you've committed that made you subject to arrest.
I don't know. Right? I mean, I know that they, yes, I agree that there could have been cross-examination about the fact that he knew that there was an indictment for his arrest, and certainly that he had a warrant out for his arrest and his knowledge of that warrant. We're not disputing that. I don't think that all the details about the other information would have been properly within the scope of cross-examination.
Okay, so what, I guess that's an interesting argument. Is there any like line of precedent that suggests that's what would have happened? Because I'll just tell you, like, my thought was probably what would have happened is that the government would have been able to say, let's talk about the crimes that you committed that made you know that you were subject to arrest. But you say that they would be limited to say, like, let's talk about whether you knew there was a warrant out for your arrest.
I think that that's right, Your
Why?
Honor.
Why? Just give me some support for that idea.
I don't necessarily have a case off the top of my head, but I don't think that it's relevant within the meanings of 401 and 40, that it's relevant cross-examination. So long as they can, if that is not an issue at trial, his guilt as to counts one or two, and that's the purpose potentially in severing these trials, then I think that his cross-examination would have to be a discretion in limiting that cross-examination.
I'd step away from the cross-examination because you started by saying that you thought that the evidence would have been different mm-hmm. on the trial that would have just been about the evading arrest or
yes.
What would have prevented the government from saying we want to provide the background for the jury about why he was being arrested?
I think they could have introduced evidence that there was a warrant for his arrest. Mm-hmm. But again, evidence has to be relevant, right? And it also is subject to 403. And so I don't know how you can bring in all of the evidence that was admitted, because it wasn't just limited to his conduct, right? You have this enormous amount of testimony about his, from the two agents who were testifying about the gang, the background into the gang, all of that evidence. And you also have all the co-conspirator hearsay that came in. But I understand the court's concerns about that issue, and so I could turn to the multiple conspiracies issues if the court is more interested in that.
Just before you get there, so we've got this old Fifth Circuit case, Williamson. How do you distinguish that? Is it just the fact that these crimes in this case happened on different days?
I think that's the main distinction. But in addition to that, in that case, the evidence about the underlying crime, I think, had to be relevant, because my understanding is that there was no warrant out for or had to be admitted because that was the basis for the arrest. There wasn't a pre-existing warrant that people were trying to execute. And so that is, I think, makes that pretty different.
That makes sense.
Okay, thank you. Turning to the multiple conspiracies issue, I think there was a material variance here, because while the indictment charged only one conspiracy, the evidence that the government chose to present at trial established two conspiracies.
Now, we're reviewing this for plain error.
That's correct, Your Honor. This was not objected to at trial. But I think when you look at the evidence clearly shows that there was a conspiracy involved, mainly led by Gary Sartor and involving the other nine trade gangsters members. And then there was a separate conspiracy with Cedric Hill and Eric Balcazar. And while they provided methamphetamine to the nine trade gangsters conspiracy, that does not make them co-conspirators. And that's clear from this court's case law. And Coy, Glinton, and Andrews. And Glinton, specifically, it says, it is clearly not sufficient simply to say that the defendants each shared a common goal, to wit, profit from the sale of cocaine. And I think that is very applicable here. The fact that that Mr. Hill and Balcazar provided some narcotic to the NTG conspiracy does not make them, does not join them together as co-conspirators. And that's also clear from this court's decision in Dekel, D-E-K-L-E, the 1999 decision, where it says that the joint objective of conspiracy is missing where conspiracy is based on an agreement between a buyer and seller for the sale of drugs, and that parties to sales agreements may both agree to commit a crime, but they do not have a joint criminal objective of distributing drugs. And when you look at the government's actual evidence here, it was clear that Gary Sartor was distributing drugs and running a drug distribution scheme, and that was to benefit him and the gang, and Mr. Hill was not a member of that gang. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Webster. Ms. Morris.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jessica Morris on behalf of the United States. I want to start by addressing the severance issue that took up most of the time this morning.
It seemed to me the Williamson case made that an easy issue.
Certainly the Williams case is binding precedent, and the facts are almost on point. We have a drug transaction tried at the same, a drug charge tried together with an assault on an officer charge. There are some differences, as Ms. Webster pointed out, but certainly that case is binding precedent. And
well, it's admissible to prove motive, right?
Correct.
It's admissible to prove the officer was engaged in the performance of official duties that morning, right?
That is correct as well.
And of course, the evidence of flight is admissible to prove consciousness of guilt.
That's correct. And
it's hard for me to see how there could be any compelling prejudice here.
The government agrees with Your Honor. And just to clarify a few points in response, the court doesn't need to find that all of the evidence is mutually admissible because what the court needs to do is look at whether there was compelling prejudice, as the court has already said. And the question that the district court was dealing with was judicial economy. Did this make sense to sever, looking at these prejudice factors compared with the interests of judicial economy? And so that doesn't actually require a one-to-one overlap of evidence. Yeah. And while the district court didn't have the benefit of knowing what the evidence was when the court made that determination, sitting here now and assessing prejudice, we can actually deduce a lot more of what that overlapping evidence would have been. And Judge Pryor, I believe, asked about the flight evidence, the attempt to flee. And I just want to clarify so that everyone's on the same page that, of course, the assault charge dealt with attempt to flee from the FBI agent the morning of that arrest in January 2018, but we also contend that the attempt to flee in the context of the drug case in connection with the October 1st, 2017 transaction would be admissible. And that's a granularity that, of course, the district court wouldn't have been able to engage in at that time, but now in assessing prejudice, we know that a substantial amount of the drug evidence would come in whether to prove the strength of the government's case and the defendant's motive to flee, or even maybe as 404B evidence, so an alternative theory. But at the end of the day, substantial drug evidence would come in to include the recording calls surrounding that, the defendant's attempt to flee from the Atlanta Police Department in October.
Webster said that the fact that there was a warrant in this case means that sort of evidence of the underlying crime would have been irrelevant. Well, what do you say specifically about that? If I understand her position, it's basically all you really needed to show here on the fleeing was that he knew that he was subject to arrest because a warrant had been issued, and it didn't really matter whether there had been a crime committed or whatever.
So the government's contention that the fact that there was a warrant, I understood that to be in the context of distinguishing the Williamson case, mm-hmm. Where there wasn't a warrant. Here, there was
But she was also saying that in this case, because there was a warrant, if you had the separate trial, there would be no need for the government to produce any evidence about the drug crimes that led to the warrant. I think that's what she was saying. It all seems, I took her all of her argument to basically go down to the distinction that there was a warrant here and that all of this evidence about the underlying crimes would have been irrelevant because of the existence of a warrant.
We disagree with that. It's our position that the fact of the warrant would be admissible. The details of a warrant, the fact that it was a warrant for a federal drug conspiracy, and that would be made relevant by the fact that the defendant actually sent a text message, which was admitted through the testimony of Agent Cleary, stating that he knew he was wanted by the feds on a drug conspiracy, and that there was evidence he looked up the press release, the DOJ press release in connection with the takedown in October of the 29 other individuals who were charged with him. So we believe that the warrant, the details of the warrant, and also the strength of the government's case, evidence regarding the strength of the government's case would be admissible to at a trial just on the assault, because that was relevant to his motive and desire to flee.
Yeah, it seems to me that the strength of the evidence that supports the warrant would make it even more admissible because it shows that his motive for evading capture is even stronger. Not only is he wanted, they've got really good evidence against him.
That is our...
Not only, in his consciousness of guilt is all the more heightened by the fact that there's lots of evidence that he's guilty.
Yes, Your Honor, that is our contention. And that factor of the strength of the evidence was one that the magistrate judge in his report and recommendation did explicitly mention. I don't believe it was reiterated in the district court's de novo review in her order, but the magistrate judge did mention this factor, the strength of the evidence. But again, there it was hypothetical. It was, the courts at that point doing the best they could with what they knew. But now, in assessing prejudice, we have the benefit of the record.
If I knew I was wanted for arrest on a warrant for something where there was mistaken identity or something like that, I might not be thrilled about it. I might want to escape the police, but I also might be a lot less concerned about that than I would be if they had really good evidence against me and I knew that they likely did.
Those are the arguments that we would make, Your Honor, below on that issue.
You want to talk about the variance?
Yes. With respect to the multiple conspiracy issue, which is raised, as the court pointed out, for the first time on appeal and is subject to plain error review, the whole test revolves around prejudice.
Now, this is a one-defendant case?
This is a one-defendant case.
That makes a difference, right?
At the end of the day, it's our contention that a reasonable jury can and did find the existence of a single conspiracy where the defendant was the only one charged in the indictment. The evidence was presented in such a manner that it focused on his involvement in the conspiracy. The wire cuts that were introduced focused around proving this October deal, the November deals, and contextualizing them. There were some that were for the purpose of context. But in view of the way the case was charged, the evidence was presented, it's our contention that a reasonable trier of fact can and did find the existence of a single conspiracy. And as the court points out, this was a single defendant case, and there are no cases on point that in this situation. Richardson was a single defendant case, of course, but there the court found no variance no variance.
So the government didn't have to prove that all the people named in the indictment were members of the conspiracy, and the jury was so instructed, as I understand it, right?
That's correct. And I think importantly here, the defendant just can't show that had there been, had this case been charged, had there been two conspiracies charged, or had there been a multiple conspiracy instruction, that his defense would have differed in any way. In the closing arguments, his counsel emphasized that the government hadn't proved the objective of the conspiracy, and we produced no evidence that he was aware of the overall objective. So, I mean, the defense counsel at closing and through the case, you know, attacked the government's proof on the conspiracy, and they also took a much more specific tact as well. They emphasized that there was calls about marijuana, and urged the jury to find that, if anything, the defendant was a marijuana dealer, not a meth dealer. So there's just no indication in the record that had there been a multiple conspiracy instruction, had this been charged, had the defendant been charged, you know, in a smaller, more narrowly articulated conspiracy, in the same indictment with a larger gang conspiracy, that his defense would have changed in any way. And as a result, he simply can't meet the third prong of the plain error analysis. If the court has no further questions, the government will rest on its briefs and return the remaining time to the court.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. Ms. Webster, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, in Williamson, that defendant testified, and the court found that his testimony would not have changed, which is certainly not the fact that we have here, or that his testimony was not responsible for a verdict did not make a difference. And so I think that's another distinguishing fact. Judge Brasher, I think you're, just to clarify, I think you're understanding of my argument, it was exactly correct. Here, I also want to emphasize that the district court has made findings already that he had an important need to testify and a strong need to avoid testifying on the other fact, and the government has not established why the court's findings in that regard were clearly erroneous or otherwise erroneous. As to the warrant issue, I understand certainly Chief Judge Pryor's point about the evidence, but to be clear, he didn't know what evidence they had at the time. He might have known about his own behavior,
if he knew that he was in fact guilty of what they wanted him for, then he might be concerned they can prove it. I'd be a lot more concerned about something I knew I was guilty of being proved than something I knew I was innocent of.
I just want to be clear that the strength of the evidence, the wiretaps, all of the gang evidence, he didn't know any of that, right, at the time. There's no indication that he knew that there were wiretaps recording his phone calls or anything else, or that the surveillance. And so I just
knew what he had done.
He knew what he had done, but he did not know necessarily the strength of the government's evidence. Although turning to the multiple conspiracies issue, while Richardson was a one defendant, or while this is a one defendant case, it's in that one defendant went to trial. He was not charged by himself alone in a conspiracy, right? Initially, he was charged in a drug conspiracy.
Jury was instructed that you didn't have to prove that all the people named in the indictment were members of the plan, right? And it doesn't seem like you even contest that he and Balcazar were in their own conspiracy.
I don't think I contest that, Your Honor, but I think that instruction actually does not help the situation, or it doesn't alleviate our concerns. The jury was never instructed that they had to find that they were part of a single conspiracy, and instead they were told that he didn't have to know other people. And the government also argued that in closing, that the fact that he didn't know those other people didn't matter one iota, I think is the quote from, which might be true when you're just challenging the sufficiency of a conspiracy evidence, but when the argument is that there are multiple conspiracies and he's not a member of that conspiracy, and the jury was never instructed that they had to find that he was, that there was one conspiracy, the conspiracy charge, as opposed to multiple conspiracies, that's a problem, especially because under this court's case law, it's as to the material variance issue, if a jury could find that there was one single conspiracy and there's substantial evidence to support it, that is sufficient to affirm. But for a jury instruction question on instructing on the multiple conspiracies, the question is sort of flipped, which is there evidence that could have supported the finding that there were two conspiracies? And I think that's very clear that there is certainly evidence that could have supported it. And so as to the instruction issue, I think that that is a serious problem, especially when you look at the other language in Richardson, which says what we are concerned about when we're talking about this instruction is whether or not you have a big group of people and you have someone who's being drawn in at the periphery. And that's what's happened here. Mr. Hill clearly was not part of this gang about the overarching conspiracy, and he was drawn in at the periphery, and then that allowed the government to introduce a ton of evidence, including a massive amount of co-conspirator hearsay that would not have been admissible if he was not part of, or should not have been admissible because he was not part of that same conspiracy with these people. And so that is clear prejudice. The government says it's about what his defense would be, that the defense wouldn't have changed. That's not necessarily the issue as to affecting the substantial rights. It's about the prejudice he suffered from all of the other evidence coming in, including the massive amounts of co-conspirator hearsay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. We understand your case, and we're going to move on to our second case.